Hello. You're listening to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles, a product of Lee Enterprises. My name is Chris Lay, and I am the podcast operations manager here at Lee. With Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles, we're presenting notable true crime stories, as reported by journalists for the dozens of various Lee Enterprises-owned publications from around America. For this collection of episodes, we're focusing on Omaha, Nebraska, where journalists from the Omaha World Herald newspaper will tell the tale of two sets of brutal double murders that took place 5 years apart and shocked the otherwise quiet neighborhoods where they occurred. Initially, police were confounded by the crimes, but eventually investigators found themselves on the trail of an unlikely suspect whose arrest was followed by a bizarre and high-profile trial. Episode 6, which you're about to hear, was written by Omaha World Herald staff writer Henry Cordes, based on his reporting alongside fellow World Herald journalist Todd Cooper, and it was read for us by the World Herald's digital director, Z. Long. Next week, you'll hear an interview with Henry Cordes, where I get to ask him about what it was like covering the story as it unfolded, where things stand now, what effect it's had on the community, and much more. So make sure that you're subscribed to get that in your podcast feed as soon as it drops. Now, it might go without saying, but given the subject matter here and every story that we're going to document, there are some obvious content warnings to impart. Any stray curse words have been bleeped out, but otherwise everything you hear would be fit to print in a newspaper. That said, parents are still cautioned to give the episode a listen before sharing this with any youngsters. And now, here's Z. Long reading episode 6, titled The Trial.
In the days after Anthony Garcia's arrest in a pair of double murders, the Omaha detectives who continued to investigate the suspect found themselves making frequent visits to the Terre Haute strip clubs. They weren't going there to watch the dancers, but to interview them. Talking to neighbors and others who knew Garcia, the detectives had learned that the doctor had a propensity for dropping lots of money in the two strip clubs in that Indiana town. The detectives decided to stop in at the clubs to see what they could learn about the doctor. In their visits to Club Coyote, the dancers kept telling the detectives the same thing. You need to talk to Ryder. Ryder was Garcia's favorite dancer, they said. She knew him better than anyone. The detectives didn't realize it at that time, but they were about to meet the star witness of Garcia's upcoming trial. Detectives Ryan Davis and Nick Hertford learned that Ryder's real name was Cecilia Hoffman. They tracked her to an apartment in Terre Haute. While some of the dancers they tried to speak with in recent days weren't particularly open to talking to the police, Hoffman welcomed them inside. She proceeded to tell them what she knew about the man she and everyone else around the club knew as Dr. Tony. She told them he spent a lot of money for private dances, particularly from her. She told how he had started coming on to her, which ultimately made her decide she needed to push away her best customer. And then she dropped a bombshell statement. In an effort to impress her, Garcia once admitted he had killed a young boy and an old woman. It seemed a clear reference to the 2008 murders of Tommy Hunter and Shirley Sherman. During that interview, Hoffman shed a lot of tears. She had chosen not to believe Garcia, dismissing his words as a joke or an effort to impress her. But now these detectives were in her home, investigating the very murders Garcia had alluded to. As the emotions spilled out, Davis and Hertford could see that Hoffman was honest and sincere. They were convinced she was telling the truth. When the detectives returned to Omaha, it soon became clear to everyone what an important witness Hoffman could be when Garcia went to trial. Garcia would be going on trial simultaneously for two sets of murders, the 2008 deaths of Thomas Hunter and Shirley Sherman, and the 2013 killings of Dr. Roger and Mary Brumback. Prosecutors decided to combine all four murder counts into a single trial because of the similar motives and the similar means by which the killings had occurred. But the evidence they had in two sets of murders was like night and day. Put simply, the state had vast amounts of physical evidence against Garcia in the Brumback murders. Using the cell phone and credit card records, Detectives Derek Moyse and Nick Hertford and Ryan Davis had been able to track Garcia's digital footprints all around Omaha on Mother's Day 2013. Subsequent to Garcia's arrest, Nick Herford, the Omaha Police Department's cyber sleuth, even found searches Garcia had made his cell phone looking up the Brumbacks' address just minutes before the murders. Garcia had cleared the phone's search history in his apparent effort to cover his tracks, but that didn't prevent Hertford from finding the deleted search stories elsewhere on the device. And the prosecution even had DNA evidence that placed Garcia in Omaha that day. While they never found any DNA at the Brumback crime scene, a swab taken at the Beatrice back door after the failed break-in attempt that same day produced DNA that proved a perfect match for Garcia. Throw in the trove of incriminating documents found soaking in the sink at Garcia's home, and prosecutors could literally throw the kitchen sink at Garcia in the Brumback murders. Contrast that with the scant physical evidence prosecutors had linking Garcia to the killings of Tom and Shirley. The fact that he had owned the same make and color of car as the dark hair, olive-skinned man seen around the Hunter home. Even that evidence was weakened by the fact that none of the neighbors 5 years after the fact had been able to pick Garcia out of a photo lineup. A defendant in Nebraska who kills four people typically would have a reservation on death row. But if Garcia's hired defense team could create enough doubt to fight off conviction in the 2008 killings, it could save Garcia from a death sentence. It seems Garcia's team, the Chicago husband and wife attorney duo of Robert Mata Jr. and Allison Mata, also recognized what an important witness Hoffman could be, because in the summer of 2015, Hoffman was visited by a private detective hired by the Matas. Steve Yonke, a former sheriff's deputy, was a mountain of a man, standing about 6'6", with Garcia's trial at the time just a few months off. Yonke stopped unannounced at Hoffman's home in Terre Haute. Later accounts of the tone and tenor of that conversation varied wildly. The defense cast it as a candid interview, a moment in which Hoffman admitted she made the whole story up about Garcia. The prosecution would cast the conversation as one in which Yonke misrepresented himself as a police detective and then tried to convince Hoffman her testimony wasn't needed at Garcia's trial. At one point, Yonke stood inside Hoffman's home. He put Allison Mata on the phone. According to Hoffman, Allison said the words to the effect of, "Honey, I would love for you to disappear." Omaha police officers became aware of Yonke's visit to Hoffman even before it had ended. Hoffman at one point began to doubt the man who had flashed a badge at her at the front door was even truly the police officer she assumed he was. She called Detective Ryan Davis in Omaha, telling him there was a detective at her home suggesting she didn't need to testify against Garcia. Davis told her the man wasn't an Omaha detective, and Hoffman put an end to the interview. The incident was typical of the brash, no-take-prisoners approach Robert and Allison Mata took in defending Garcia. The pair spent months during pretrial hearings clashing with prosecutors over the Terre Haute incident, and many others. Robert Mata at times screaming at the top of his lungs. In the end, Allison Mata would get booted from the case by the judge over another controversy that arose: false statements she made about the DNA evidence against Garcia. Allison would continue to serve with her husband on the defense team, but would not be allowed to sit at the defense table during the trial. When Garcia's trial finally opened in the fall of 2016, more than 3 years after his arrest, it was arguably the most sensational criminal trial in Nebraska since the notorious mass killer Charles Starkweather faced a jury more than a half century before. The first day of testimony at the trial featured heart-wrenching words from Bill Hunter, describing the day 8 years earlier that he came home from work to find the bodies of his 11-year-old son and longtime house cleaner, both with knives impaled in their necks. During the early days of the trial, Derek Moyes would spend more time on the stand than anyone, given his incredible penitent for having been on the scene for every critical moment in this case. On the second day, he described the abominable scene he found in the Hunter home. He was called back to testify to the carnage he walked into at the Brumback house 5 years later, and the entire eerie similarities with the Hunter scene that he had noted right away. Then later, he spent hours meticulously taking the jury through the investigative path that brought detectives to Dr. Anthony Garcia, the black binder, the Creighton termination letter, the Honda CRV and pastel license plate, the hit on the Iowa cell phone tower, Garcia's Omaha credit card purchases, his SD9 handgun, the convenience store video. Every time he took the stand, Moyes faced a grilling from Bob Mata, nitpicking his technique and conclusions. Moyes kept his cool, relishing the chance to defend his work. By far the most riveting testimony came on day 9 of the trial. A striking woman with a thin frame and long reddish-brown hair, Cecilia Hoffman, strolled into the courtroom and took her seat on the stand. Up to that point, Garcia had gone through the trial showing little interest in the proceedings, refusing to even speak to his own attorneys. But now seeing his favorite stripper on the stand, surely had to pique his interest. Hoffman talked about her days as a stripper at Club Coyote. Now a mother of two small children, she says it was a life she had left behind. "It's not anything I'm proud of," she said. "I was obviously dancing. I was addicted to drugs. I drank a lot. It was just not a very stable time in my life." At Club Coyote, Hoffman said, Dr. Garcia was gregarious, outgoing and engaging, flashing wads of cash and flaunting his medical degree. When he walked in, the DJ would often announce that Dr. Tony was in the house. Hoffman said dancers often competed for big spenders like Garcia. He would offer hefty tips for getting a private dance from a stripper, the way dancers made the big money. Whenever Garcia came in, Hoffman would drop what she was doing to shower him with attention. But it eventually became clear to her Garcia wanted more than just a private dance. Once Garcia got down on one knee and proposed to her. Another time, he told her he had a dream she had his baby. Another time, he tried to kiss her. Hoffman knew the time had come to push Garcia away, so during a smoke break outside the club, she said she tried to let him down gently, telling him why she was rejecting his advances. "You're too good for me," she recalled telling him. "I'm a bad girl. I like bad boys." "I'm not really that good," Garcia told her in response. "Actually, I've killed people before." Hoffman said she challenged Garcia, disbelieving what he was telling her. That's when she said he told her, "Well, it was an old woman and a young boy." She pressed more, asking why he would do such a thing. "They deserved it," he told her. "Well, maybe they didn't deserve it, but I had to, and I feel bad." Even courthouse novices that morning could see just how damaging Hoffman's testimony had been for Garcia. She was essentially saying he had confessed to the 2008 Dundee murders. Mata Jr., in his ensuing cross-examination, had a simple task, straight out of the defense attorney's playbook: destroy the witness's credibility. He first got Hoffman to admit that part of the job of being a stripper is to give customers the illusion they are interested in them, the way to keep them coming back. In other words, lying and deception are a big part of the job, he said. She agreed. He then pointed out that some of the things Hoffman had said in her talk with the private detective Yonke, statements in which she seemed to back off of what she had told Omaha police. At one point, she said, "I can't stand by anything I said or did in that time of my life." Sitting on the stand, Hoffman struggled to explain those words. "No further questions," Mata said soon after. He surely believed his pointed questioning had badly undercut Hoffman's confession claim. In the back and forth of the courtroom, it was now time for the Omaha prosecutor, Brenda Beadle, to seek to resurrect the earlier testimony of her star witness. Beadle firmly rejected any notion that Hoffman had spontaneously recanted what she had told the Omaha detectives. Beadle noted all the times that Yonke had led her with his questions, such as when he suggested that she may have been too drunk to remember exactly what Garcia said. "He put a lot of words in your mouth, didn't he?" Beadle said. "Yeah," Hoffman replied. "I was hoping I wouldn't have to testify. It kind of seemed like he was giving me an out." Beadle pointed at Yonke, sitting in the front row. She asked Hoffman how she felt with the 6'6" private detective towering over her in her house. "I was terrified," she said. From the defense table, Mata audibly scoffed. As soon as Beadle finished her questions, Mata launched into his second cross-examination, cutting loose on Hoffman's words. "Scared of what?" Mata asked. "Do you think he was going to harm you? Is that what you're saying?" Hoffman stammered, repeated that she had said she had been scared. Mata then marched up to Hoffman, his voice building to a full-throated scream. "You're terrified of a guy who's showing you a badge that says he's a private detective, but you're not terrified when some guy tells you that he killed people? That's what you want this jury to believe? "Objection," Beetle shouted. "Set down," the judge implored. The drama subsided. That's when Hoffman quietly leaned into the microphone, and in a soft voice she answered Mata's question in the process of taking a sledgehammer to his effort to impeach her testimony. "When some pervert in a strip club tells me a joke, it didn't scare me." At that, Hoffman held a tissue to her glistening eye and dabbed at her running mascara. Several jurors squirmed in their seats. One juror, a young woman, shot a cold stare at the defense table. Jurors had deliberated only 7.5 hours before the bailiff was notified they had a verdict. There was quite a stir as nearly all the major players in the 8.5-year drama filled the courtroom. Garcia was up front with all the members of his defense team. The families of Tom Hunter and Shirley Sherman took up their places in the gallery. And sitting in the very back row of the courtroom, flanked by the police chief and leaders of the task force, was Detective Derek Moyes. While Moyes didn't make a habit of showing up for the verdicts of cases he had worked, the detective felt compelled to be there for this one. Everyone knew the first count would be the telling one, the charge of killing Tommy Hunter. If Garcia was guilty of that crime, he would be guilty of them all. The clerk began to read the jury's finding. Guilty on count one, the first-degree murder of Tommy Hunter. And down the line, the murder convictions came. Guilty, guilty, guilty. As the counts rolled into one after the other, Garcia showed no emotion. Cocking his head back and leaning back in his chair, in the back of the courtroom, Moyes felt more relief than elation, particularly for the families of the victims. All his work in this case had been for them. They had lost so much. More than a year later, the doctor-turned-serial killer was wheeled back into the same courtroom. Either sleeping, feigning sleep, or in some kind of catatonic state, Dr. Anthony Garcia was oblivious to the proceedings as the Nebraska justice system decided if he should die for his crimes. More than 10 years, exactly 3,838 days had passed since the day Garcia calmly walked Omaha's streets before ruthlessly knifing Tommy Hunter and Shirley Sherman. It had been 1,952 days since his return trip to dispatch Roger and Mary Brumback. But on September 14th, 2018, a 3-judge panel decided Garcia's fate, sentencing him to death for the quadruple killings. Going into the hearing, Garcia's public defenders acknowledged he had murdered 4 innocent people, but they argued that there were mitigating circumstances and they should spare him capital punishment. That he was never cracked up to be a doctor in the first place, pushed into it by his parents. After he failed to keep up with his studies, he became drunk and stressed and mentally ill. Burdened by his profound failures, Garcia came to fixate on the doctors he believed were behind his troubles. But the judges didn't find any legal grounds in Garcia's sad personal story that could overcome the gravity of his crimes. The judges were unanimous in their decision to send him to Nebraska's death row. He remains there today as his case goes through appeals. Before Detective Derek Moyes helped crack the Garcia case, Moyes was already and arguably one of Omaha's top homicide detectives. But after Garcia's trial and conviction, Moyes became, in the words of one longtime department veteran, a rock star. He and Detectives Nick Herford, Ryan Davis, and Scott Warner shared Omaha's Officer of the Year Award. Moyes was prominently featured when NBC's Dateline and CBS's 48 Hours aired news documentaries on the Garcia case. Still, Moyes was having none of this talk of his celebrity. He was quick to point out that he just happened to be the detective who first set foot in the Hunter home. The detective who by chance was on the call when the Brumbacks were killed. And the one who was handed Garcia's personal binder. It was just dumb luck, he said. As much as Moyes left his mark on the Garcia case, Moyes would see over the years it also left a mark on him, one that was as undeniable as the tattoos down his arms. Years later, he could be doing almost anything when something, a sound or a smell, would trigger it. A vivid image of Tom would flash into his mind's eye. "I've always kind of felt I can't let that one go," he said. Part of what made it so hard to forget was the tragedy of it all. 4 lives, ruthlessly and senselessly cut short. That was probably best summed up one day in 2018 by Detective Scott Warner. That guilty verdict was not going to change the fact Thomas was not allowed to grow up and become what he was supposed to, or that Shirley's life was cut short, or that Roger and Mary were robbed of the chance to move on to a new chapter in their life, he lamented. And for absolutely no reason whatsoever.
Thanks for listening to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles. This series was written by Omaha World Herald staff writer Henry Cordes, based on his reporting with fellow World Herald journalist Todd Cooper, and read by the World Herald's digital director, Z. Long. You can get loads of other information at omaha.com, and links to relevant articles and content can be found in the show notes. Make sure that you're subscribed to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles wherever you listen to your podcast, so you'll be the first to hear our next episode, which will be coming soon. The show was produced and edited by me, Chris Lay, with tremendous thanks to Henry Cordes, Todd Cooper, Z. Long, and the rest of the team at the Omaha World Herald for the work they put into covering, researching, and recording the story. For Lee Enterprises, I'm Chris Lay.